Good afternoon. Welcome to session 3238.0, War and Public Health. My name is Barry Levy. I'm a professor at Tufts University School of Medicine, and together with Dr. Victor Seidel, who's Distinguished University Professor of Social Medicine at both Montefiore Medical Center and Albert Einstein College of Medicine in the Bronx, we will be moderating the session, actually later presenting one of the papers at the session. Neither of us have any conflicts of interest to acknowledge. And without further ado, I'm going to turn it over to Dr. Seidel to introduce the first of the four presentations this afternoon. Dr. Seidel.
Good afternoon. It's a privilege to be here to introduce this session. This is the fifth or sixth year. How many years is it, Barry, that we've been doing this session?
18, I think.
somewhere between 18 years and 6 years that we've been doing this session. And the Peace Caucus has been just an extraordinary part of the work of APHA and sponsors this session. It also sponsors a number of other sessions, and if you'd like to see them listed, there is a copy of, in fact, they have been passed out. Does everyone have a copy of the Peace Caucus newsletter? Because in that newsletter are all of the sessions that the Peace Caucus is sponsoring at this APHA annual meeting. The other change that I want to point out is if any of you have picked up the flyers for the social medicine session that immediately follows this one. It's at 2:30 this afternoon. And on the flyer, if you've picked it up, it says the convention center, this room. It is not in this room. It is in the, unfortunately, in the Marriott Hotel in the Laguna Room. So if you're interested in a bilingual session on social medicine, it's the first time in APHA history that we've had abstracts in both Spanish and English. So if that interests you, it'll be in the Laguna Room at the Marriott Hotel. And now on to this wonderful war and public health session. Our first speaker is Dr. Ira Helfand. Dr. Helfand is an emergency room physician, practices in Western Massachusetts. But while his day job is extremely important, it is other activities for which we know him and honor him. He has been working for PSR for virtually all of his professional life, I think it's fair to say, Ira, and has moved up in that organization so that he is currently the head of the security program at the Physicians for Social Responsibility. He's also a longtime part of PSR as an affiliate of the International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War, as you know, the Nobel Prize winning organization. And Ira is now the treasurer of IPPNW. The reason that he has been invited here, not only for all of his accomplishments, is because of a paper he has recently produced. And the title of that paper is on the screen. And this was presented in London, has gotten a marvelous reception, and is being used around the world as evidence for what a minor nuclear war, in quotes, an exchange of nuclear weapons could produce. So it's an honor to introduce Ira Helfand.
Thank you, Victor. It's a real pleasure and privilege to be introduced by a former professor at my age. Not only that, but a professor who still runs rings around me in terms of the activity that he does for peace around the world. So thank you, Victor. I have some slides, but I'm going to kind of skip over most of them because of the time constraints this morning. I want to talk to you about this research that we've produced in the last year, looking at the effects of relatively limited nuclear war on climate and on human health. We have known for some time that a major war between the United States and Russia would be a huge global catastrophe extending far beyond the borders of those two countries. But in the last couple of years, we have also learned that a much more limited nuclear war, one involving perhaps only 100 Hiroshima-sized bombs, less than a half of a percent of the weapons in the arsenals of the world today, that a war of that magnitude would also have global impacts. The research of people like Brian Toon and Alan Robach, which I will try to bring up for you here, has shown that this kind of an exchange would produce an enormous amount of soot and debris blasted up into the higher levels of the atmosphere, and that it would have a dramatic effect on global climate, dropping the temperature an average of 1.25 degrees centigrade over the entire surface of the planet, and also shortening the growing season in some of the most important agricultural areas around the world. To get some sense of what magnitude drop in temperature we're looking at, this slide shows the rise in global temperature over the last century, the global warming that we have become so concerned with. And this shows that 1.25 degrees centigrade drop occurring over the course of a few months. As you can see, it is more than twice the increase that we have experienced. And it leads to, these are very difficult slides to look at. Let me give you a couple of blow-ups. These are the shortenings of the growing season in some of the major grain-producing areas in North America and in Eurasia. The major effect that this climate disruption would have on human health would be mediated through the decline in agricultural production. We do not at this point have any accurate estimates of exactly what the decrement in agricultural production would be. But we do know from previous experience with other cooling events in the past that it would probably be quite significant. In 1816, North America and Europe experienced what was known as the year without a summer. This was caused by the eruption of the Tambora volcano the year before in Indonesia. That eruption had, through the same kind of mechanism, lifting aerosol material into the atmosphere, dropped global temperatures 0.7 degrees centigrade, about half of the decline we would expect with a regional nuclear war. And that cooling, that was enough to produce widespread crop failures throughout North America and Europe, causing extensive famine in Europe and major disruption here in the New World as well. The model that Toon and Robach have used suggests that the cooling that would take place after regional nuclear war would last not for the 1 year, which we experienced in 1816, but for perhaps as long as a decade. And there is one event in human history which probably parallels this, which was the cooling that took place between 536 and 545 AD, also in response to a volcanic eruption in Indonesia. This is much less well documented. The record from that period is extremely fragmentary, but there are references in literature from Byzantium, from China, from Japan, from Korea, of extensive devastating famine during that entire decade. And the archaeological evidence from here in the New World also suggests that there was a terrible drought affecting much of the continent. At that time, most of the decline in agricultural production was due simply to cooling and some decrease in precipitation. In the event of an event caused by a regional nuclear war, there would be several other factors taking place as well. First, there would be very major disruption of the ozone layer, and the resulting increase in UV light reaching the planet's surface would further decrease agricultural production. Secondly, there would almost certainly be a major diversion of agricultural production for industrial use. We use a lot of the grain produced on the planet now to make oil, to make ethanol as an oil substitute. And in the event of a regional nuclear war, there would almost certainly be a further and significant diversion of corn and other grains for ethanol production to make up for the interruption in petroleum transport. Finally, and perhaps most importantly, depending on where this regional war took place, very large areas would be contaminated with radioactive material, and the food grown there would not be fit for consumption. It might be consumed anyway, but it's food which shouldn't be taken out of circulation. Now, at this point in history, we are extremely ill-prepared to deal with a major disruption in food supplies. As of August of last year, when I did the research, we had approximately 56 days worth of grains stored globally, 56 days worth of consumption. This is much less than the historical average of 100 to 120 days over the last 30 to 40 years. And it is not enough to provide any kind of a significant buffer in the event that there is a decline in food production. Furthermore, at this point in time, there are on the planet about 800 million people who today, under the existing conditions, live at the brink of starvation. there's a lot of debate about exactly what constitutes the, you know, sort of the minimum requirements. But most experts agree something in the range of 1,800 to 2,000 calories a day for the average adult is what is necessary to maintain minimal amount of physical activity and maintain body mass. And there are about 800 million people who are at or below that level. Any further decline in their consumption would be catastrophic. In addition to those 800 million people, there are several hundred million people who live in countries, mainly in North Africa and the Middle East, but also in East Asia, Korea, Japan, Taiwan, Malaysia, countries which at this point enjoy relatively good nutritional status, but which are dependent for up to 50 or more percent of their food on grain imports, and countries which would therefore be very vulnerable if international traffic in grain were disrupted. So what we face is the possibility that a regional nuclear war would cause some decline in food production. We don't know the exact amount. We do know from studies that were done of the Great Bengal Famine in 1943 that it takes only a very small decline in available food to trigger a very major decline in accessible food. The decline in actual food production in Bengal in 1943 was only 5% over the average of the preceding 10 years, and it actually was about 13% higher than it had been 2 years before. But during that year, 1943, the Japanese had occupied Burma, which had traditionally been sort of the backup source of rice for Bengal. And that combination of events, the occupation of Burma cutting off imports from there, and the decline in food production in Bengal itself, triggered a fivefold rise in the price of rice and widespread hoarding. And these two events combined led to the death of 3 million people in 3 months' time. In the event of a regional nuclear war, I think we would have to expect enormous rises in the price of grain on the world market and enormous hoarding. Countries like the United States, Canada, Australia, Argentina, the major grain exporters, knowing that this crisis was going to last for a number of years, would simply cut off the export of grain and hold on to their own stocks to feed their own people. And I think given that, it is reasonable for us to fear, we don't know for sure, but it is reasonable to fear that most of the 800 million people currently living on the brink of starvation, and many of the several hundred million people living in countries dependent on food imports, would in fact die. And a global toll in the range of 1 billion people is realistic and what we need to be planning on. Now, this has enormous implications for nuclear weapons policy and suggests that now we know that it's not just the arsenals of the United States and Russia, but the arsenals of all of the nuclear powers which threaten human civilization. The scenario of 100 warheads that was used to generate these figures is based specifically on the arsenals of India and Pakistan. That's what their combined arsenals contain today. And a war between those countries could also have this kind of a global impact. And that has implications for their national policy. It has implications for the way the rest of the world views not just the US and Russian arsenals, but the arsenals of the other nuclear powers. I want, however, do I have a couple more minutes?
Sure.
I want, though, to just quickly move from this topic to what I think we need to understand is still the major nuclear threat, because as bad as the danger of a regional nuclear war is, the major threat that we still face is the danger of a large-scale nuclear war between the United States and Russia, which continue to maintain between them some 2,600 nuclear warheads on hair trigger alert. And a war involving those countries would have even more catastrophic consequences than the regional limited war that I've spoken about already. A study that we did in 2002 showed that if only 300 warheads from the Russian force that is maintained on hair trigger alert were used against US cities, the death toll in the first half hour would be 90 million people dead. The entire economic infrastructure of this country, the communications network, the transportation network, everything that we depend on for our survival would be disrupted. And in the ensuing months, probably the vast majority of people in this country would die. The comparable US attack on Russia would have the same effect there. And most importantly, the global climatic disruption would be gigantic. The limited war between India and Pakistan involves about 1.5 megatons of nuclear explosive, and it lofts about 5 million tons of dirt and debris into the atmosphere. A war involving the on-alert forces of the United States and Russia would involve about 1,200 megatons, and it would loft 50 million tons of debris into the atmosphere, and it would drop the temperature on the entire surface of the planet, not 1.25 degrees, but 4 degrees centigrade, which is a temperature which we have not known on this planet since 18,000 years ago at the worst moment of the last ice age. We have essentially created and maintained a doomsday machine on this planet without even understanding it. In the movie Dr. Strangelove, that was kind of a joke that the Russians had built a doomsday machine. What a dumb thing to do. That's exactly what we've done. And that machine is in place today. It is functional, and it can go off at any time. And I would argue that this is the most important public health issue in the world today. During the course of this meeting, we are going to be looking at many very serious threats to public health. I believe that the danger of nuclear war stands alone in a category by itself. This is not some abstract threat that I'm talking about. At least four times that we know about since 1975, we have come within minutes of having an all-out nuclear war. The most recent in 1995, a full 6 years after the end of the Cold War. And those are the episodes that we know about. This is the greatest challenge that we face as physicians and other health professionals. It is our highest responsibility, and I'm very grateful for the opportunity to talk with you about this this morning. Copies of the two papers I've referenced are on the table over there. I hope that you will all join PSR and help us in getting out this word and taking advantage of the extraordinary opportunity which the election next week may offer us to change these disastrous policies. Thank you.
We have a couple of questions. Questions from the audience. Also, very clear and very depressing. But if, please.
What were the circumstances around those episodes? No, we know about some of them. There was one in 1979 when the Russians thought that picked up something on their radar that they misinterpreted as an attack from the United States. There were two in 1983. One on September 26th, when a cloud formation over North Dakota was again misinterpreted by Russian satellites as a U.S. launch. And actually, when one, I think it was a colonel, Stanislav Petrov, in Russia, short-circuited the thing, they picked up that there was a launch and they should have launched a retaliatory attack against the United States. And he, on his own initiative, refused to do it. About 3 months later, the Russians thought again that we were about to attack them. This was the height of the Reagan Cold War, after we had deployed the Pershing missiles in Europe. The most recent episode, and I think in many ways the most frightening, was on January 25th of 1995, when the United States launched a rocket in Norway to study the Northern Lights. We informed the Russians that we were doing this, but somebody in Moscow dropped the ball, and the Russian military radar system was not informed of this launch. And they picked up this rocket and interpreted it initially as four warheads from a U.S. submarine off the Norwegian coast heading to Moscow with an impact time of about 6 minutes. And for the only time that we know about in the nuclear weapons era, the little suitcase that the Russian president carries to respond to a nuclear attack was activated, and Boris Yeltsin was given 5 minutes to decide if the world should live or die. The options on that on the console, from what we understand, were they range from doing nothing to launching a full-scale attack against U.S., which at that point, 95, would involve 4,000 warheads. Russian military doctrine, and the U.S. has the same doctrine, is launch on warning. If we believe we're under attack, we're supposed to counterattack and not wait for the missiles to land. And that's what Yeltsin should have done. We don't know exactly what happened that morning. Yeltsin had all kinds of health problems. We don't even know if he was the person making the decisions. But somebody decided instead to wait things out and not do anything about it. And within a few minutes, it was clear what the trajectory of these warheads, this missile was. January 25th, 1995 was an absolutely normal day. The Koreans hadn't tested their nuclear weapons. The Indians and the Pakistanis hadn't tested theirs. 9/11 hadn't taken place. We weren't at war in Iraq. We weren't about to go to war with Iran. And we almost blew up the whole planet. And those are the ones we know about.
I want to thank Ira very much and to make one comment before we give him a round of applause. You've seen at the bottom of the screen the initials of IPPNW, which is the International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War. IPPNW has 60 affiliates in 60 countries around the world. One of them is in the United States, Physicians for Social Responsibility. So if you want to learn more about these issues, want to try to do something to prevent all of this happening, join PSR.
And so let's give Dr. Helfand another round of applause.